Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Degas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Damian Dresick, author of Fables of the Deconstruction, published by Clash Books in July 2021.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having cocktails while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading sounded like a great combo. Today, we're drinking a last chance inspired by Damian's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
For those not familiar with Damian's work, Damian Dresick is a novelist and short fiction author whose creative work has appeared in more than 50 literary journals and anthologies, including W.W. Norton's New Micro, Post Road, Cut Bank, Smoke Long Quarterly, and New World Writing, among others. He has been the winner of the Harriet Arnau Award and the Jesse Stewart Prize. He is co-host of WANA Live, a virtual reading series for Appalachian writers. He teaches writing at Clarion University of Pennsylvania. Fables of the Deconstruction, the short fiction collection we feature today, is published by Clash Books. As author Steve Allman says, Fables of the Deconstruction is funny, sad, dreamy, and brutal. The stories here veer off in strange directions, happily disobedient to the conventions that plague so much of our current grindingly cautious literature.
Not unlike his literary forebears, Donald Barthelme and Robert Coover, Damian Dresick brings us a crackling series of dispatches fresh from the postmodernist front. This daring gathering of brief, innovative stories tantalizes the intellect nearly as much as it illuminates the human heart. Drawing from his quiver of flash fictions, prose poems, lists, pie charts, and micros, Dresick's narratives are fully engaged with the wild disorder that every day feels more and more like the sine qua non of our fractured now. Meet meth-addicted grizzly bears, a coal mining Jesus, grieving alcoholic parents, and murderous villagers whose only speech is culinary in this fleeting-edged tour de force. Fables of the Deconstruction. We are so excited to hear Damian talk about it today.
Yeah, how are you feeling today, Damian?
I am outstanding. Thank you guys so much for having me on. I've seen the folks that you've been featuring, and I feel very privileged.
We're privileged to have you. Well, today we are looking forward to hearing you talk about your work and also having you give us a reading a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I love giving live readings. I feel like each of us is possessed with so much energy, and you can either use it in fairly toxic ways or try to impart it to others. And I think like the live reading gives you the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I agree with that. Damian, for our listeners who are not familiar with flash fiction, can you explain it a little bit, both how you would describe it and then also how you write it? Maybe how it's different than writing a longer short story.
Certainly. The sort of traditional definition of flash from a word count standpoint has been that stories that are under 1,000 words. And there's a broad array of shrinking, you know, of ever larger or ever smaller definitions where you've got like sudden fiction at 2,000 words, micro fiction at less than 250 words. So there's this sort of, you know, gradation of the actual length. But I think part of what makes flash fiction fundamentally different is this sort of jamming of the gears kind of effect that a writer is aiming toward, where you sort of construct a world for your readers, and then in some way, and not gimmicky, and that's what makes it tricky. Not gimmicky is to turn that world on its head. And I think you're trying to get people to question their reality. That's sort of what you're looking to do.
Wow. So that in a way that you don't, I'm just curious, I'm just trying to delve this a little bit more. So if you get readers to question their reality in a way that you don't feel that other forms question that reality, like maybe speak a little bit more to that.
Well, I think in, let's say, a traditional length novel, you're in a certain place and time, a certain world, so to speak, for a not insignificant period of time, maybe 200 pages, 300 pages.
Yeah.
So it's a world filled with its own physics and its own moral vectors and its own nuance. Mm-hmm. Whereas in flash, by the time you're in, you're almost out.
That's the truth. There's a lot of white space. Yeah, wonderful. Well, I'm very interested in the experimental components of the stories of this book and the Flash that's in it, but as well as everything else that you're doing with it. Some resemble PowerPoint slides, some look like Word documents in track changes mode, like maybe rasterized or something of that nature, and others felt a little more metaphysical and playful. As someone who experiments with lit, what informs those choices for you? How do you say, oh, today I'm going to write a really unusual piece?
I'm pretty sure that if you sort of set out to write a really unusual piece, that may be a good recipe for disaster. at least based on my own experiences setting out trying to write a really unusual piece. I think part of what drives the need for this brand of experimentation is the fact that as readers, as just participants in culture, we're so overstimulated. We have various messages, whether vote for this person or buy this stuff or this is a bad idea, going on all the time for us. And I think it's a matter of survival to build up these sort of filters in your head. Well, I'm just not going to pay attention to all of this. And I think that's a lot of what's driving both the need for Flash and the positive response to it, is that this sort of gesturing toward experimentation, it does shock you a little bit and creates maybe an opening where there wouldn't otherwise be one. I also think that there's technological changes. I taught this class at the University of Pittsburgh on narrative and technology, and we looked at the impact of technological shifts on how narrative was constructed and communicated. And we started with the printing press. And if you go back, you know, you think about what kind of books would you write if you had to kill a sheep, turn the hide into something you could write on that would last forever? Well, that creates a bunch of questions. And wait, all of a sudden the printing press comes along and, you know, 200 years later, the idea of the commercial models of printing becomes something very different. And the kinds of narratives that people might be interested in become different, partially because the kinds of people who are reading are different, who can afford books. Mm. And then we get to like it's no coincidence that the rise of Flash is timed almost exactly with the rise of the internet and internet penetration rates for the majority of folks. I don't think anybody's going to want to read War and Peace on their phone.
Right. You sort of addressed what I was about to ask you next, which was talking about how Flash fictions gain momentum because of all the things that you just talked about, our shortened attention spans, the internet, the quicker reads on social media, how things just sort of flash past us. So my next question would be, what do you envision as happening next? Like, if we're here now, what do you think is next as far as like literature and Flash and things like that?
That's a really good question. I mean, I kind of actually want to jump back a little bit. When I first started writing Flash, it was in the early 90s, and I just took a class in grad school with Buddy Norton, and you had to produce a story a week. And this was I think part of what also appeals is the rise of the MFA program, because if you're trying to teach people to write, you have these relatively limited pieces of text. You can understand things like how plot works or how characterization works in the sort of really abbreviated way where you're not having to wade through 20-page stories, both as a writer or as a reader trying to provide feedback. And this was super engaging. I was thinking about like MTV at the time, which was still a little bit new, and the idea of like flash cuts and just very short pieces of narrative rather than like a 2-hour movie becoming normalized. So that also, I think is important in terms of thinking about the evolution of Flash. Mm-hmm. That again, that you talk about the kind of declining attention span, and the internet only accelerated that. The future, boy, that is an interesting question. I'm not entirely sure. One of the things that I see that really engages me a lot is more and more novels being told through linked Flash, but not even being marketed that way. Mm-hmm. I wrote a review of, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the work of Angie Cruz. She wrote a novel called Dominicana, and it's in no way marketed as a novel in Flash, but at the same time, the entire thing is basically 3-page sections, one after another, for 350 pages. So I think its incorporation into the novel form is one thing that we can perhaps expect to see more of, because it allows you to kind of get the world of the novel, while being kind of bite-sized. And I think more and more authors appreciate the sorts of jolts you can give a reader by using Flash.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that'd be really, really cool.
Yeah, we've had a couple of people on the podcast who had something kind of similar. We had Debbie Lascar, her Atlas of Reds and Blues was written in very short, very poetic chapters. If you look, the structure of like things like Sandra Cisneros' House on Mango Street, mm-hmm. very similar short poetic chapters.
That's actually sitting right in front of me. Oh, sorry.
Oh, wow. I think that that is definitely a thing, but it's interesting when you were talking about the cinema, because I've been thinking a lot about that myself, in that in the past, it seems like movies used to be longer. People would be writing screenplays that were closer to 2 hours, 120 pages, and now it looks like 105 is the golden spot for a feature-length film. But by the same token, we're also in this golden age of television where people are writing these essentially miniseries, like almost like full movies that are 12 hours long, which is a season of something on the various channels. So I wonder how reading impacts that particular measure. Did people float towards Flash, and are they now going to float toward the longer form again? Or is it just constantly in flux, right? So I have another question for you. I really like how something that's really great for me when I'm reading fiction is when something is funny. And I particularly like when it's slyly funny. And I even like when it's slyly tragic funny. So therefore, there were a lot of things in your stories that I found entertaining. But I really like how it can be fun to choose your own adventure. And there are elements of that in this book. There are like call outs to different genres of different things altogether than Flash fiction. Like I like the story, The Fungible Trajectories of Carol, which speaks about female promiscuity and the difference between expected outcomes, or in this case, story endings, for those with liberal mentalities versus conservative expectations. When you wrote this piece, did you want to start an argument?
Well, if you'd asked many of my friends, they would say that's just my natural way of moving through the world.
Yeah, well, it was a fun tension, right? I'm thinking, who did he write this piece for? And how did he think they would respond to it?
No, that's a great question. I think like political ideology has morphed in such powerful and toxic ways, particularly on the right, that its ability to frame a worldview that allows for no compromise is something that I think demands comment from writers. I think in some ways writers are, I mean, in another context, I'm involved in some political activism, but I think, you know,
no surprise there,
but I think every act of writing is a political act just at base. Yeah. That's, you know, we're either reinforcing a status quo or holding it up to the light and saying we can do better as a species.
Yeah, for sure.
Heather, you were just talking about the tension in that piece, and I'd like to kind of broaden it out a little bit and come back to that idea of Flash, because I'm really interested in it and curious about it. And I was wondering what role tension and mystery play in a Flash piece.
Let me add one more sentence about the last story.
Okay.
The other thing I wanted to say was that something else that I felt was an important statement to make was, folks on the left, I sometimes feel like every conversation is just some version of that old song lyric, you know, mostly say hooray for our side. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, saying, look, we need to interrogate why you have these beliefs. What are you really after here? There's a demand for introspection on that side as well. Okay. I think tension is absolutely central to Flash. I think that's one of the key things when you're trying to teach somebody how they might learn to use what gifts they have as writers, using Flash as where you're at. It's how to build up that tension. I think in some ways, it's a little bit like, and I don't do stand-up, but I have friends who do it, and they talk about this idea of it working primarily because you're creating a moment where people are in some way uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's some of what I hope to do in this, because I think there's a sort of psychological opening that comes with that. Like the opening story, for instance, when I do it live, I don't read, I just go up and recite. No paper, no nothing. And you know, it's very, try and do it very dramatically, you know, and talk about like my mom jumping off of a building.
Oh, what a beautiful sentence that was. Let me just stop there and say that I loved that opening. Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. And people presume that I am literally telling a true fact about my life. And it's just like the whole room shuts down.
Wow. Let me follow that up, like right after that whole paragraph with, and now here's another thing that's true. So you like ratchet the tension and then a little bit let it loose and then ratchet it up again mm-hmm. and then let it loose. Exactly. So that piece actually has even more push-pull, I think, than some of the others, to be honest.
That's sort of, yeah, what I'm getting at is, you know, maybe the reality that you, you observe and initially believe to be true, believe to be, this is what's actually happening here mm-hmm. on Earth at this moment. Wait a second, maybe that's not really the case. I think questioning reality is one of the things I was very interested in doing, in exploring in the book.
Right. And there's a lot that simmers under the surface too, which creates a lot of that tension. One other thing I was really interested in about this book is how many male characters are carrying a sort of lower middle class rage, some sort of class warfare energy. Can you speak to that? What do you want the reader to come away from this book with regarding class and gender? That poverty makes men mean, that privilege many enjoy should be called out or contrasted as such, since there are some pieces that really just give a slap to capitalism and how it enslaves the poor and enriches the rich. Is there something else? What did you want to bring to that? Because I feel like the class narrative is really strong in this book.
I'm going to say thank you. I'm not sure that was a compliment, but...
It totally was.
No, but you're absolutely, I mean, like calling attention to economic disparity and the fact that people assume that capitalism is as native to Earth as gravity is something that I felt very compelled to call out. One of the things that's very strange about, you know, being a writer who writes a lot about working class stuff is the only story I've had anthologized in Norton is one of the ones that mentions somebody having a summer house.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Because it's the privileged making selections in literature. Is that where you're going for with that?
Well, I think, you know, you sell books to people who have money to buy them a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, true. And then not only that, but if any writing has an intellectual aspect, the saleability goes way down because there's a smaller population who's willing to absorb that level of craft, right? Right. I mean, do you notice that?
Oh, I think that's true in a lot of arts. Until things have gotten some stamp of approval, whether it's through like a collective consciousness or simply time, you know, when Rothko is originally doing work, it's like, oh, that stuff is absolutely crazy. What kind of maniac is it? And then 50 years later, when it's worth a lot of money, people go, oh, well, this is clearly the work of a genius. This is, you know, a miracle right. of artistic intent. I love Rothko, by the way. I don't, you know.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, time tells the value, right? I mean, how many Nobel Prize winners do people not even know their name? And you think a Nobel Prize in literature is the biggest thing there is, right? But can you say the names of the last 50 winners? You know, most people can't.
Yeah.
So.
No, absolutely. There's a wonderful essay when I was auditing a class and for when I was doing my PhD, and the essay is called The Slaughterhouse of Literature.
Wow.
And it sort of uses, it doesn't use the Nobel, but it uses other things like sales or mentions in newspapers, other mm-hmm. prizes. You know, it's like, look, you know, you think these were, like out of all the number of books that come out in a certain year period, 10-year period, 20, 50-year period, how many of them will even be remembered at all later? And will these even be the ones that people at the time thought were a big deal?
Right. I mean, like, it's the whole Melville thing all over again. It's the whole thing of like his most famous, most popular books were not Moby Dick, right? He thought that that was a failure at the time he died.
Yeah. So, I think you're right that it's true of all art. I think it goes for art for sure. I have a question about your revision process. I wanted to know if you would talk about your revision process for the collection. I read in a Smoke Long interview that you were spending time trying to tweak, club, argue, and pair the stories for your readers. And by the way, those verbs very accurately reflect my own revision process. But I wanted to know if you could talk about the revision process specifically for your collection.
Absolutely. One of the things that I think is strange in writing... In writing a novel, one might come, at least from my own experiences, you know, the novel is the novel. And you're going to, you know, okay, I've got to make these changes to this chapter, or this character needs to be sharpened, or, oh boy, I really went off the rails here. I have to pull the narrative back. Whereas writing a collection of Flash, there's, I believe, 72 separate stories in here. Each of them had their own demands in terms of revision. Mm-hmm. One of the stories that did the most in terms of getting words and things. It literally came to me as fast as I could type. And I didn't even think it was very good. It was until a friend of mine who was a poet, I sent her like 10 stories and said, hey, I'm trying to send these out. How would you think about these stories? And she's like, oh, well, I would say this one is really great. And I'm like, well, no. And I think this is true of a lot of writers until they get more confidence. I'm hoping to have more confidence soon. I think there's this tendency to equate the amount of effort you put into a story with its quality.
Yeah.
But there's also that weird line, right? I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had a story where people are like, oh, this is amazing. This is so freaking great. And it's not my favorite story. In fact, it's not even one that I would have classified as one of my best. When I talked to a co-editor, I used to be a poetry editor in a journal, and the fiction editor for the journal would constantly say to me, how dare this person send me this piece of crap? Why are they sending me their worst work? Why aren't they sending me better material that just is, it's offensive to our journal. They should send me their top work. And I would say, honey, maybe they think they are doing that. You know, you don't know. Maybe they think this is their best story. And that's the whole thing. So many people have said to me anyway, oh, maybe it'll be your magical realism stories, or maybe it'll be your form poetry, or maybe it'll be your literary novels, or maybe it'll be your experimental thing. And each person has their own philosophy about what's going to be the thing. But do you think Nabokov thought for one freaking minute that Lolita was going to be the thing with all the other brilliant stuff he wrote? I would hope not, because I don't think that's his best work, right? But you look
That might be one of those, nobody ever went broke underestimating the taste of the American public.
It's crazy, right? I mean, am I wrong here?
Well, a couple things. One, I think sometimes we value like particular pieces of work by how much they help us progress as an author. Like, I learned to do this, this, and this while drafting this piece. Therefore, like, I'm seeing this tremendous value to it, or it helped me to process something in my life.
You don't think there's journal-based inflation? Like, if it got accepted at a really good venue, you suddenly think it's your best piece?
Yes. It's like, oh, I didn't have any, you know, but now that it's, you know, in blank, I obviously it's
one of my greatest stories ever, of course.
Obviously, this is the best one, or something else would have got picked up by them the 30 other times I sent them a story. No, I'm just kidding.
That is one of the funny things, though, that I think as a writer who sends out a lot of stuff, when you do Flash, I think you're a little bit more like a poet, where you're like, boy, you know, this story got turned down by like the 10 mid-tier places, and then so I'm really, you know, you kind of, maybe I just really misjudged whether it was any good or not. And then like someplace way up the food chain takes it, and you're like, oh, well, that's, you know, what do you make of that?
Yeah, it's insane. And it all depends on which editor is reading it on which day and which themes appeal to them for what reasons. There's a lot of things that are factors that I think are not even connected to the excellence of the piece necessarily.
There's other things you're really, really grateful for. There are rejections for which you are truly grateful. One of the pieces that's in the book, I'd shown to Mark Drew at the Gettysburg Review, and Mark was like, this isn't really doing it. And I really respect him a lot. And I don't respect him enough not to send it out 10 times. And of course, it kept getting rejected. And then I had this like minor epiphany and spent a couple of weeks revising and moving this and moving that. And then the first place it ended up, it got, after the revisions, got picked up. So I was really grateful that nobody had bad enough judgment to take it before that.
Well, okay, I'm going to change the question just a little bit, just because I want to make sure I get to this today too. But I agree with you. It's very relative and interesting. About the treatment of women in text by men. This is, of course, always something for me when I'm reading. I was reading this morning a Murakami interview in which he said he doesn't, quote, really have anything to do with all the isms of the world, end quote. He's not a, quote, anythingist, end quote, which I thought was quite playful and fun for me to read in the context of knowing I was going to have a conversation with you today. Because he also said, I just make an effort not to write anything in my stories that would hurt or show contempt for someone because they're male or female. There's a lot to me of gender questions and things that are going on in your stories. Does anything inform your writing of gender, or are you just writing from the cuff?
I think unless you are out to, I think in terms of writing any character, what you're trying to do is dimensionalize that person, no matter who they are, to the degree that their motivations, while even if they're exceptionally disagreeable, will be apprehensible to a reader.
Yeah, certainly. But I noticed you have characters with different sexual orientations too. How did you choose to balance what you chose to include in this book in terms of the amount of focus on male narrators, the amount of focus on different orientations, that sort of thing? How did you pick the lineup?
I think that's more a question of I just wrote the world in which I live. For instance, The Fungible Trajectories of Carol is based loosely on a personal friend who is going through a few things and then came out on the other side.
I ask this because when I'm putting together a collection, sometimes the table of contents will shift like 15 or 20 times while I'm trying to decide what order things are going to go in. And sometimes editors will change it up for me. Did the editor change it up for you, or did you make the calls on this?
This was originally turned in as a doctoral dissertation. I actually finished most of it prior to doing the doctorate. But I gave it a lot of thought for the dissertation because I knew I was going to be shopping it subsequently. It had actually, weirdly enough, it had already been picked, I don't know if I want to say this or not, but it had already been picked up a while back, and a press went broke like two months before the book was supposed to come out. I mean, money had been spent. It was a crazy situation. So I had a bunch of stuff and I wrote a bunch more stuff, and I sent things out to like three or four trusted friends who had been first readers for things and said, you know, I think I might be a little, I mean, there's some where I'm thinking there's stories that whether you're right or you're wrong, you think are very strong work. And you try and I think start with some of those, end with some of those, and make sure that there's no moment where things don't pop in some way or move in an interesting way as folks go through the collection. Mm-hmm. And I kind of came up with something and then sent it out to three friends and said, what do you guys think of the order of this? And I got some, I'd move this here, I'd move that there, and sort of took all that in. And that's what I ended up with the order.
It's great that you have some strong reader friends that can give you that kind of feedback.
Yeah, I keep having to send them money.
Was this a money arrangement from the start? I'll put you on retainer for $450 a year to read the drafts of... No, I'm just teasing.
I have a question about place, and I was wondering what role place plays in your writing.
Oh, thank you for asking. In this book, you certainly see flashes of the northern part of Appalachia where I grew up and where I live presently. In my other work, that landscape is much more dominant. A lot of these stories were written with perhaps a more cosmopolitan perspective. I lived in New York for a very long time, lived in New Orleans, lived in Los Angeles, Paris a little bit. So I wasn't living outside of New York. I wasn't living in any of those places when this was written, mm-hmm. but certainly the experiences of having been there as a resident helped to inform the book.
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of New York. I'm seeing a lot of Brooklyn move through this book as well. And I'm seeing a lot of California. So I'm definitely seeing that LA element coming in, which as a Californian, I can't help it. I always notice when there's California in a book. So here's a question for you. California and Hollywood play an interesting part in some of the stories, which delights me as a screenwriter churning out screenplays right now and wrestling with pilot ideas. So as I had mentioned or may have mentioned, I love the story, We Must Leave This Arid Land Where the Relentless Sun Beats Down, for example. Can you speak to what draws your short fiction toward the movie biz?
Well, this is one of those funny, just sort of looking around my life. When I lived in Los Angeles, I worked for one of the five big talent agencies. And that was, as if you're working in that industry, you know how insular and circumscribed your world is. That everybody who's not in it is kind of a civilian.
Mm-hmm. that's true.
You're out and people, especially in California and LA, because it's a company town in ways that growing up in a company town, like with the company being a coal company, you're sort of that way of viewing the world is already sort of one you've, at least I've come to hold as a filter. And you look at LA and it fits like all the things map onto. There's basically one, unless you want to work in real estate, there's like one industry here and there's a very rigid power structure. At least when I did this, very rigid power structure, very questionable set of strange ethics. what constitutes normal behavior is unique to that environment.
Yeah, I know this story isn't connected, but there's a story in this that's very meta, where it's like people have the opportunity to sponsor Damien for various levels of eco-friendly and sustainable behavior, which strikes me as a very California idea. So even though that one isn't like laced with California, it feels like a Californian story. I can see that. Do you feel like the ideology of that place kind of filtered through on different things you were creating here?
Oh, absolutely. The sort of...
Is it the ambiance or the expectation or what?
Well, I think in some ways, I aspire to be a model of literary filial piety with maybe, say, Joan Didion and Bret Easton Ellis as two among dozens of parents. And so, you know, reading this work very young, it's like, well, California is what you write about. If you're going to write in a certain kind of way, the only subject fit for that is California.
Absolutely.
Well, I will sponsor you for the shampoo.
Why, thank you. I can avoid the shit from the dollar store I've been using. I'm very grateful.
Oh, it's hilarious. I'm like, where do I click the link? I'm such a capitalist rat. Okay, I'll do that one. Oh, wait, this is just a story.
I really like the story, I'm not sure I'm going to say it right, Ab Initio?
Yes, Ab Initio, yeah.
Ab Initio. It has such vibrant verbs, and it really just moves across the page for me. And the reverse chronology and the repeated before that, they were so compelling and really just pulled me through the piece. For me, a lot of the stories explore the notion of causation. And this story is a great example of that, how Szymanski was shaped by what happened to him before. Can you tell us what came first for this story, the idea or the structure?
This is back when Borders existed, and I was in Borders, and I, like many writers, have psychological problems. I was reading a Black's Legal Dictionary, which is, it's like all these legal terms. I just happened to pull a copy of it off the shelf, and I was like, oh, ab initio, from the beginning. And I was thinking about a story that Hannah Bottomy had written. It was in one of the Nortons. I'm going to say like Flash Fiction Forward, that sort of toyed with the same conceit. Mm-hmm. And like, what if I like this conceit. I like this idea of from the beginning, turning it upside down. And I wanted to tell, you know, there was a lot of tension about people being involved in the war in Iraq and how I think there's perhaps a tendency to, for some, to not apprehend the degree to which certain people's options are very limited.
Right.
And this can pull you into a world that you otherwise would certainly not have selected for yourself.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, I read the story too. I read it from beginning to end, and then I read it again from end to beginning. Which
you're very devoted.
Yeah, well.
That's a compliment, right? Read
yeah,
it twice.
I wanted to see how it would read differently looking at it from the chronological beginning to the end. I really liked it. Also, I wanted to know a theme that kept, like I said, popping up for me was the idea of causation or how the past shapes us. Was this a theme that was in your head as you were crafting some of these stories or as one that's interesting to you?
Yeah, I think so. Certainly.
He is not sure.
It's a funny thing, because how I started writing this collection, I was reading, do you know the Fairy Tale Review?
Oh my gosh, yes, of course. Okay, yeah. I love fairy tales.
Yeah, so Donna Tartt, I think, had some pieces in there, and I'm hoping she's not the editor of it. I haven't read it in a little bit. But I was really interested in retelling, like sort of toying with these stories. So I had this idea that I was going to rewrite Rumpelstiltskin as a court case, with Rumpelstiltskin doing like sort of this pro se thing as his own attorney and telling the story, which I don't know if that's a good idea or not, but if it is a good idea, it's one that a far better writer than it would take a far better writer than I am to make a success of.
Nah. So
I spent every night, like I would work, I wrote the whole book as a night watchman between teaching gigs. And every night I'd sit down and try and work on this story. And I'd get 15 minutes into it, I'd read what was on the computer and say, there's not a sane person in the world who would be interested in wrapping fish in this, let alone, you know, reading it for literary value. So I'd like, okay, well, I've got to sit here. I've got to keep working. And there were some things that struck me as important. And one of them was class difference and the smugness of the upper classes.
Yeah.
And the kind of literature that targets it's sort of like, oh, people who are lower class or working class their stories aren't worth talking about. People who are marginalized, their stories aren't worth talking about. And that was something that was a strong impetus for me. I want to say, well, no, this is one of the driving things for the book. So in that sense, causation, well, how did we get here? That interested me absolutely.
Thank you. That's really interesting. I appreciate that answer.
Yeah, and it's really interesting you should mention the fairy tale review because, of course, in the title of this book, you have the word fables, which always kind of, to me, is slightly connected to the idea of fairy tales, you know, fables and that sort of thing, tales of that nature. Well, we are really looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from Fables of the Deconstruction. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's booktail cocktail is called The Last Chance. The recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make one and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. It's made of gin, vermouth, creme de violette liqueur, lemon juice, simple syrup, and a little bit of tonic water at the end. So you add everything except for the tonic water, shake it up, strain it into a coupe glass, and add a splash of tonic water. It's really delicious.
Fantastic. I made mine in a skull glass. You'll see
That's
it.
An awesome
I thought, oh, this will be nice for his book, this skull. Is there anything you'd like to tell us about the passage you're sharing today?
So the only magazine to ever be threatened with legal action due to publishing my work was the publisher of this story. And that is why the woman is named Sabine, because the name of the character was somebody I knew in California who believed that she would be recognized with the use of her first name and being in California, in Los Angeles.
Oh.
Even though nothing else in the story happened to her.
Interesting.
That was the quirkiest thing that ever happened to me. That's why I changed it for the book. I don't need anybody else to be threatened to be sued.
No.
Okay, great. So
maybe say things after. I don't know. We'll see what occurs. So I'm going to read now.
Yeah, do it. Let's hear it.
Okay. We must leave this arid land where the relentless sun beats down. The soft-soled bottoms of her feet, inches above the rutted asphalt, Sabine floats down the loose, twisting curves of Laurel Canyon Boulevard. The sequined hem of her diaphanous dress trails behind her like the train of a wedding gown. She is soundless as a ghost. Sabine is going to Fred Siegel to drink a hazelnut latte in the sun and purchase several pairs of elegant imported socks. The socks are to be a present for her lover, a corrupt and on-the-lam portfolio manager who is, unbeknownst to Sabine, presently shacked up in a mid-priced hotel in Palm Desert with a 22-year-old production assistant. The assistant's name is also Sabine, and she has recently come off a 9-week assignment, getting coffee and being berated by a prominent director whose heartfelt film is a favorite for this year's Academy Award. Registered trademark. Disturbingly clear, the day is one of the few each year that the small island next to Santa Catalina can be easily seen from the narrow, cantilevered deck that juts out from Sabine's bedroom. With uncharacteristic industry, Sabine's two thick-bodied Labrador retrievers have dragged a pair of Eames chairs from their proper place in front of the fireplace out onto the narrow deck. Their tails tucked genteelly under their hindquarters, they sip Darjeeling tea from fragile, tiny cups and watch the sun strike the Pacific Ocean in the distance. "Woof," says Luciano, the wiser and more resigned of the two. "You can say that again," says the other. Finishing their tea to the dregs, the dogs plot how they will distract Sabine in order to facilitate an opportunity to shred, rip, and eventually eat the newly purchased socks of the unscrupulous portfolio manager when he returns from the mid-priced hotel in Palm Desert. Where does a story go from a place like this? Talking dogs? Floating women? A clear day in Los Angeles? If we look to the title for direction, it suggests that someone must leave a hot, dry place that is doing them no good. The portfolio manager, shacked up in Palm Desert, he certainly qualifies. So then does the production assistant, but alas, both seem far too minor characters to be referenced in the title. Maybe the hot, dry place is Laurel Canyon, and the dogs are the ones who must leave. Search out a better life in which they are cared for by a thoughtful, nurturing master, one who is not so completely consumed by her attempt to win an Academy Award trademark. With her heartfelt, yet overly determined film, that she goes through life entirely unaware of how remarkable they have become. Learning Italian on the sly so as to belt out arias from Verdi's Aida next to the grand piano in the great room when she is away on location. Then again, maybe the story is some type of metafiction, and it is you or me that must leave this California, this lotus land of surfers and jasmine. But no, that can't be right. I have no idea where you are reading this, and I have not lived in Laurel Canyon for years. And anyway, I am writing this from a coffee shop in Union Square in New York, where it's pissing down rain. The truth must be just as you suspected all along. It's high time for Sabine herself to take it on the hoof. Yes, she just needs a little push, a bit of encouragement, an assurance that she deserves and is capable of better. That would surely make for a story with more depth than one in which the main appeal is the conceit of talking animals. Sabine, inside you, is a hot, dry place where the rain never falls and the sun is assiduous as judgment. If you were listening, you must move on. Do you hear me? Move on. The California inside you is sterile as Mars. This is one called Life Lesson. It's 1972, and the war, unpopular now even in the suburbs, sputters on. My father, not a Buddhist monk, nonetheless flirts with self-immolation. Slumped on our blacktop drive next to the roadmaster, he's poured a quart of Fleshman's gin down the front of his chest. His left hand toys with the wheel of a Zippo. Alice, he shouts to my mother. Alice, get out here! When my mom, beehive blonde and rayoned, comes rustling through the screen door, he smears some of the gin into his hair, a splash across his whiskery face. Have this baby, he tells her. I swear I'll go up like Dresden. Even as my mother sprays him down with the garden hose, calls for my uncle in the house across the street, my father is laughing. I can do this any time, Alice, he says. That was the story that I suggested gin might be the base liquor of choice for our book tales, Fables of the Deconstruction cocktail. This is a story called Cleanliness. I come home to the smell of meat, not the subtle wafting of sirloin tips or pounded cutlets sautéing as a prelude to being served with thick sticks of asparagus, but the concentrated odor of raw meat, pungent, sweet, overpowering, as if our front door led to the killing room of an abattoir. Briefcase still in hand, overcoat across my shoulders like a cape, I follow the broken trail of styrofoam packaging and plastic wrap through our cramped shotgun apartment to the bathroom. Chops and shanks, roasts and ribs oxidize in a brown heap next to the space heater. My boyfriend, a firefighter who's recovering from a bad time, hunches in our cramped tub, drizzling the remains of one of the packages through his thinning hair. When I ask what has happened, he smiles beatifically up from the tub. I spent $170 at the butcher shop, he says. He is nude. His pubic hair is soaked flat against his body. A pool of thin red fluid has formed beneath him and rises nearly to the tops of his pale feet. Although wildly inappropriate, this macabre spectacle reminds me of the time my little sister Carol got her period in the pool. I am being washed in the blood of the lamb, he tells me finally. My boyfriend is relaxed. Unconcerned with my reaction, he keeps on wringing what I believe to be a shoulder chop across his hairless chest a little below the nipples. That's a metaphor, I tell him. That means if you go to church, God will forgive your sins. Are you so sure of that? He asks. And although in 15 minutes I will call the psychiatrist, and Lewis will spend several days under observation before returning home with his Zyprexa prescription, for this one luminous moment, the way he looks up at me from his pool of watery redness, the relief etched across his face as with numinous acid, this man I love, he makes me wonder. And So I'm a big movie buff, and you'd mentioned the sort of California vibe to some of the stories. This is sort of what happens when cinematic reality bumps headlong into actual reality, and this reality takes place in New Jersey. This is a story called Quitting with Jimmy. Three deep in line at the 7-Eleven off Route 46 in Hackettstown, New Jersey, our eyes are loosely fixed on a pimply clerk stymied by the spewing renegade slushy machine when he eases the gleaming spider into the parking lot. At first, we think he's a fake, an imposter striding across the macadam in his bright, too tight jeans, lizard skin boots, and t-shirt clinging to that muscled body like a second skin. But when he yanks open the safety glass door and enters in a penumbra of cinematic lighting, always backlit and shown to advantage, while we wilt, washed out under the humming fluorescence, the seeds of belief have been duly sown. He nods to each of us in turn, just the smallest curt adjustment of the chin, a miracle of understatement, cocking his hip and jamming a grease-stained hand into his signature windbreaker with flawless casualness. He assumes his place at the register. We coalesce around him, gazes lowered, the women among us, and at least one of the men fan their flushing faces with penny savers and oversized Garden State cash for life lottery tickets, eyes glued to his high, perfectly formed butt cheeks. His straight, bright teeth dazzle. His clear, light eyes bewitch. When he drawls, "Hey, Slim, slide me a pack of them Camel cigarettes," it is poetry. It is sublime. Rapt, we watch him fling the pack against the meat of his hand with a series of vigorous but disaffected slaps. As the clerk backs away from the counter, refusing to take his proffered bill, our eyes light on his slim white fingers as he fruitlessly pats himself down, searching for the telltale bulge of a Zippo. In one swift motion, we collectively reach into our pockets, purses, jackets, and fanny packs, seeking out the elusive match, lighter, flint, and steel, anything, as he deftly yanks away the pack's cellophane tail and shakes a filterless white cylinder from the tiny rectangular cube of desert. The amalgam of smile and sneer gracing his narrow, high-browed face as he leans into the nearest match nourishes our fragile outlaw souls like sunlight on winter wheat. The scent of burning tobacco, mingling with his honest Indiana sweat, takes us back to 1,000 unlived Midwest teenage drive-in nights where we were innocent and well-intentioned and the wide, wild world was our unsullied and flawless oyster. "Excuse me, sir," the clerk says, kiboshing our starstruck nicotine-infused reverie. "So there's no smoking in the store?" "That's so," he asks, pulling the cigarette from his plump lips. His pained grimace spreads from one of us to the next like a prairie fire. The lowered stick of tobacco smolders, penduluming at his trim waist as he attempts to discern if the clerk is somehow kidding. When, in the long moments following the clerk's remarkably concise disquisition on the Surgeon General's 1964 report on the hazardous effects of smoking and the subsequent hard-fought court battles and ensuing legislation enacted to protect the public health, 7-Eleven becomes remarkably quiet. He is the first to speak. He says, "Jesus wept." He relinquishes his grip on the burning cigarette, lets it drop to the floor. Like a ballerina performing a reluctant tendu, he raises the pointed toe of his high-polished Western boot and grinds a brown arc of tobacco flakes across the grimy terrazzo. "That's it for me, kids," he tells us. "Not another butt. At 24, I am just too young to die." On his way out, he shovel passes the Camel pack into a dented metallic waste can. Watching his spider chirp a quick 180, roar out onto the highway and shrink in the strip mall distance, we talk among ourselves in mumbles. Our words clipped, our gestures shot through with unspeakable angst. We want to warn him about the H-bomb and perestroika, school shootings, the internet, and 9/11. Most urgently, though, we want to warn him about a man with the unlikely name of Turnip Seed and something horrible that's going to happen in the desert. But if we can't save him, maybe the best we can do is save ourselves. Each in turn, we sidle toward the door and with a minor flourish ricochet our respective packs of coffin nails into the battered trash can as we exit the store back to our minivans and subcompacts, our steps imbued, perhaps, with just the smallest bit of newfound joie de vivre and borrowed swagger.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
We really enjoyed hearing you read.
Thank you so much.
We've got a couple of last questions for you. I always like to ask what advice you'd offer new writers or writers who are interested in writing Flash.
I think that's a great question. First, my advice for both new writers and anybody who's just who's a continuing writer is read the journals that you want to be included in. Subscribe to journals. Be a part of the sort of literary ecosystem. Don't be like a teenager that the only time you interact with your parents is like when you want to borrow the car. I think that's important. The other thing I would say is read actively and start taking stories apart. And that was one of the things that I kind of did, and I still do this, looking at other people's Flash stories, folks, say like a Kim Chinqui story, and sort of ask yourself, like literally work it out on paper. How does this story work? What's the arc? Mm-hmm. What sentences do what kind of work? And how many levels are they doing the work on? Everything should be doing, in Flash anyway, everything should be doing more than one thing. I mean, I like to think about Flash as having like maybe like five or six different kinds of stories. One is like object-centered, like Rick Moody's drawer. One is like a life telescoping story, like John Updike's Oliver's Evolution. You know, it's like, okay, as this author builds this story, you know, how do the parts fit together? How many lines do they use to convey thing X? What kind of secondary work is this paragraph doing? And I think once you start asking yourself those kinds of questions, you can see what when the story, like you read something and it's 2 pages long and it smacks you like an angry waiter. And you say, well, why did this happen? And you start tearing through it like, oh, because all this stuff was working exactly like this. And that's why it was so impactful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Can you tell us who or what is on your bookshelf right now? Or if not that, then who is exciting you in terms of what they are creating lately that's giving you an extra jolt?
Sure. I have been rereading Cormac McCarthy's No Country for Old Men. Really interested in the way he does some of the same kinds of things he does in Blood Meridian, but with a very different linguistic ethos. And I thought it was very interesting to see how do you port something from one verbal ecosystem to another. Other things I am looking at, I just finished reading a wonderful novel. I read a review of it. Bonnie Proudfoot's Goshen Road is working class people in rural West Virginia. It's a town called Fairchance. Better than no chance at all, I believe, is how one of the characters describes it. What else am I reading? My big reading at the end of, at the beginning of the year was The Nickel Boys and Sing, Unburied, Sing, which I felt like it was really interesting reading them so close together. It was the powerful narratives involving injustice, race, and prison.
Yeah. And just so lyrical too, the prose in both of those.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And the narrative sure-handedness was something in both texts that I found like, wow, stand back and learn.
Yeah, totally. For our final question, I wanted to ask if you would tell us a little bit about your anticipated next projects for the next 12 months.
Absolutely. So I am presently working on an essay collection called The Saints, and it is about my time.
Ooh.
About my time as a club DJ in pre-Katrina.
Oh, I'm in New Orleans, so I can't wait to read that.
Oh, I did not fully realize that. Mm. Whereabouts?
Just outside in a little part of town called Old Jefferson.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I moved to New Orleans after graduate school. I got a job as like the director of public relations of something. On my first day of work, I got within like 5 miles of the building and just said, you know what? I didn't come to New Orleans to be the director of public relations for anything. And just sort of took an exit and ended up getting a job as a club DJ.
Wow. Wow. Where at?
One of the big clubs on Bourbon.
Okay.
So it was like, if you were like wanted front row seats to every brand of decadent behavior that might ever cross anybody's mind to indulge in, that's the place to, yeah.
Oh, you're in it.
Yeah, you're like a little scalper with the front row ticket. So yeah, it's a collection of essays about that. And that's the project I'm involved in at the moment.
Excellent. Can't wait
for
that. Wow,
amazing. Thank you so much for spending time with us at Book Tales today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've been listening to various episodes. You guys have really been, this is what I say on my own show, like fortunate to get, like, you, not me, but the other folks you've gotten have been just top shelf. I mean, it's really impressive.
Oh, we've had some great conversations. We really, really enjoyed talking to you today and hearing you read.
Well, yeah. Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys doing the show and your thoughtful questions. It was wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure. So everybody who's listening, please order Damien's book, Fables of the Deconstruction, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on book tales, readings, and drinks. Also, subscribe to the podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversations with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.